Can you even remember the first time you got on the internet? Do you remember the feeling that, wow, anybody can get on here? We can all talk to each other. The web was supposed to be a strong force for democracy and equality, yet somehow, since it has matured, we seem to have less of both democracy and equality. Whose fault is that? Can we blame big tech for getting too big a piece of the action? Our guest this hour certainly points that way and suggests how we can break free and decentralize the wired world. Ramesh Srinivasan is the author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. Ramesh Srinivasan teaches information studies and design media arts at UCLA, where he is a professor. His writing has been published in several outlets, and he's a frequent guest on broadcast news shows. Ramesh Srinivasan, thanks for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here with you on Jefferson Exchange. Thank you for having me this morning.
Oh, absolutely. If you would state the problem at the outset, the internet was supposed to be so free and democratic. What happened?
And actually, we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the internet.
Oh, that's right.
The very first point of the internet started right on campus where I work at UCLA. So just here on the West Coast where we all live. So, yes, of course, the internet was and is transformative. It's had a profound effect on our lives. And as some of us remember, not even 50 years, but when the web started, you know, just about 30 or so years ago, it created the capacity for us to post content, to post information, to post messages, and connect with one another in a peer-to-peer fashion, meaning any of us had a voice, any of us had a platform, and we all could connect to one another in what seemed to be a decentralized fashion, meaning it would actually be a mechanism of bypassing traditional ways of communicating with one another. I mean, imagine being able to write letters to one another, but on steroids, right? So in a sense, the internet is a decentralized architecture where each of us has a point of access, each of us has the ability to share information with one another, and that's why it felt so democratic, and that's why it still remains so important and so potentially powerful as we strive to recover our democracy in this country.
Well, you know, when you mention things like the fact that it is not as equal as it could be, what are some of the warning signs of this?
Yeah, what ended up happening is you know, the internet, of course, expanded. It was first very, you know, small scale, but then, increasingly, almost anybody in our country had the ability to have access to the internet. Not of course, everybody. It was often, of course, correlated to people with higher, you know, wealth, certain types of geographic and socioeconomic and even demographic backgrounds. But nonetheless, it expanded in its scope. As it expanded in its scope, both domestically across the global north, but now very much across the global south in places like, you know, South America, Africa, Asia, and so on, the amount of information exploded that went online. So it became impossible for us to figure out how we would actually be able to access quote-unquote relevant information. How would we make sense of the fact that there was astronomical amounts of information, almost all of which we created, available online? So what happened is that we actually turned to platforms, right? Different technology services that seemed to be providing us with efficiency. But in the process, as we turned to these platforms, as we turned to these intermediaries, we can think of Google, we can think of Facebook, we can think of Amazon as examples of these. We are starting to, and increasingly more and more realizing that, of course, those third parties are monetizing those exchanges. They're monetizing those transactions, which on some level, many Americans would be okay with, because, of course, they deserve value. They deserve to be compensated for their ability to provide us with efficient services. The issue, however, is the ways in which they're monetizing those transactions, what they know about us, how they are steering us behaviorally, what they're doing with our information, is something that we're almost completely in the dark about. And so in that sense, as a foundational element, we can see a profound threat to our democracy as we know it in this country. And that's why I wrote this book, Beyond the Valley, because I not only wrote about how the internet has come to be at this point, but what we can do about it to restore a balanced world, one that supports business interests, but not at the cost of our rights as American citizens, not at the cost of workers, not at the cost of our own sanity, as we're increasingly finding out with the with technology addiction issues and its positive correlation to issues like depression and addiction and so on. So a lot of those themes are spelled out in my new book, Beyond the Valley, primarily because I really want people to know what has happened, not to be upset or angry about it, but to know what we can do about it moving forward.
Ramesh, do you get a lot of shrugs from people? I mean, the average user of the internet services who say, well, you know, okay, yeah, I gave up some information, but I have a lot more convenience.
Yeah. I mean, some absolutely, you know, many of us, and I will include myself in this group, are okay with being followed around with ads for, you know, a car we might be interested in buying, or maybe a sports team that we're, you know, interested in watching, or, you know, kind of consumer sorts of choices. Americans have generally speaking, been okay with advertising, even potentially targeted and personalized advertising. However, what happens when that same logic of targeted personalized advertising starts to apply itself to feeding people content because the algorithmic systems that are created by these technology companies, by these platforms, know that it will keep us addicted? Is that something we're okay with? Most people would say no. What about feeding people with content that we know is going to rile us up, disorient us, scare us, and maybe even make us feel like we shouldn't vote in our next election? Is that something we're okay with? What about information that might be known about us from something we did online 20 years ago that's available potentially to someone we're applying for a job with in now, right? Are we okay with those sorts of forms of invisible control? Those are the anti-democratic processes.
You're running through a bunch of things that we'll get to in further detail, like, you know, are we okay with having recommendation engines that look like they're there to rile us up? Are we okay with people having our money, rather our information? It seems like we are largely okay with people having our information. Can we, Ramesh, have the ease we expect of using these platforms without some cost, either dollars or info?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think people necessarily, based on the research I looked at for Beyond the Valley, have too much of a problem with a specific company or a specific service having specific types of information about us, as long as all of that is known, as long as the boundaries about that are known, right? So, for example, I'm okay, obviously, with Facebook having information about me that I post on Facebook. I am okay with Facebook having information about my likes, my comments, and so on. The question is am I okay with a shady third party that profits off of Facebook, that Facebook is designed to optimize its services for? So I'm talking about the Russian government or Cambridge Analytica. Am I okay with that third party not only having my Facebook data, but having all of my friends' Facebook data, and here's a key point, also having my credit card records? Am I okay with that? And most people across the board would say no. So the issue isn't about people being able to monetize our services. Maybe not even people, maybe the issue isn't even about these companies being able to have some data on us. It's the absence of disclosure and the sense that we are completely in the dark when it comes to these issues, because these forms of disruption are actually disruptions that actually threaten the very foundations of what a democracy is supposed to be about, which is sort of, generally speaking, a common baseline of what is known about us and what we know about others. Right now, we are being Googled more than we are Googling. We are being socialized by Facebook more than we are actually using Facebook for socialization. Do you understand what I mean? It's really a one-way street that has come to be, because that is what allowed these companies to become the wealthiest companies in the history of the world, multi-trillion dollar industry we're speaking about, from an internet that was publicly funded by taxpayer money. I know decades ago, but public investments that have reaped only private returns without a balance is the problem that I point out in Beyond the Valley and how we can get past this.
That is a major point, and that's a real stop-and-think moment in the book, that the government developed the internet, and yet the people making money off of it are private industries.
That's right. Even the web was a nonprofit initiative from Switzerland. Tim Berners-Lee is a British, you know, he's Sir now, Sir Tim Berners-Lee. He developed the web as a mechanism by which scientists and researchers could share information with one another. So the public aspects, the community aspects of the internet are fundamental not only to its history, but even the financial mechanisms by which this incredible technological achievement was able to come to be. And so in Beyond the Valley, I not only speak about the internet's history, but I talk about how this kind of private, invisible, dominated corporate logic around technology is influencing every aspect of our lives as we know it. Because our concerns around technology are not just about Facebook or Amazon or so on. It's about how every aspect of our life, increasingly, Jeffrey, is digitally mediated, right? So when I receive insurance, it's digitally mediated. When I decide to travel in a city, it's digitally mediated because there are surveillance cameras, there are mobile phones that are picking up data everywhere we go. And this is a big issue with all these new themes of the future that we might hear about, Internet of Things, 5G networks, smart cities. All of this is about technologization of our lives, but the problem is it's a one-way street within which we are completely blind. The 99% are blind.
Does it ever surprise you, Ramesh Srinivasan, that people who fear the power of government seem untroubled by the power of the big five, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Apple, and Facebook?
Yeah. I think that point did exist in recent history, but that has changed. I think one thing you see, for example, take into account a poll done by Vox a few weeks ago, is bipartisan agreement across the board that big tech has gone too far. So I think for different reasons, people across the political and geographic spectrum in our country now are really troubled by this. And part of that is because it's no longer an accurate statement to say that the corporate world exists independent of our governmental world. If anything, the corporations and the government in our country are deeply interwoven, and you know we know lots about that when it comes to things like Citizens United and lobbyists and so on. And actually, if anything, the government are likely to be clients of private technology companies that in many cases, in terms of issues of surveillance and privacy, have far more sophistication when it comes to being able to direct our behaviors and know the most intimate details about us. So that's why we see examples like, for example, with the NSA spying program that Edward Snowden whistleblew. That's why we found out that companies like AT&T and Verizon were actually cooperating with the NSA. So if anything, you have to see these systems of power as interwoven with one another.
Well, and there's another example you give in the book, which is a bit of a mind blower here about the intricate interlocking of tech business and government. The missile alert in Hawaii that scared so many people a few years ago could not be averted. Why?
because the governor of Hawaii forgot the password to his Twitter account.
And if he'd had that, he could have told people this is a false alarm.
Precisely. Precisely. The reliance we have on private technology platforms is profound. And again, they are providing us with services, but we don't understand what the costs are. That's what I'm asking for in Beyond the Valley. Let's get back to a place of balance. We can't, because now I think, we all have different reasons for being concerned about the issue right now. It might be our democracy. It might be the 2020 election. It might be the reality that automation, which is dictated by private companies, artificial intelligence systems that are going to replace human work could replace something between 30% and 50% of all jobs as we know it. That could be another theme. Maybe it's just this weird issue or this concern that we have that our children are locked into these technologies and have very little ability to resist the addiction that these technologies proffer to us. So we have lots of different reasons for being concerned about the issue. So that's I think partly why people across the board in our country want to do something about this. I'm publishing a piece, hopefully within the next 2 weeks, Jeffrey, with a major media outlet. I'm talking to multiple right now, called Why We Need a Digital Bill of Rights. And I'm asking for a digital bill of rights that really restores balance to the situation right now. And I also don't want to vilify or criminalize or malign anybody. You know, I'm an engineer by training. I'm actually an AI engineer who became a social scientist and a writer and a public intellectual because I was concerned about these themes. A lot of good people are working in these companies. They also are concerned about what's going on. It's about understanding and engineering. Often people don't think about the social impact of what they do until it's too late. So I'm holding out hope that that's the reason why things have gotten to the point where they're pretty darn broken. But I also, but either way, it's time to do something about this.
Ramesh Srinivasan, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a professor at UCLA, where he teaches information studies and design media arts. He's written about the great control that the tech world has from Silicon Valley over what we do on the internet. His book is called Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let me hear a little more about your own journey. So you were involved in AI, so you're well-versed in the stuff that goes on that tries to take advantage of the information that people put out there and decided to take a closer look at the effects it was having on the other side?
Right, absolutely. So, you know, AI is a term that, you know, we often relegate to science fiction movies back in the past, but you may be surprised to know, and our listeners might be surprised to know this morning, that every big tech company, at least all of the major ones, including Google, describe themselves as AI companies. Because what is actually occurring every time we interact with any of the products and services that most tech companies offer us is we're actually interacting with what one might call an AI or artificially intelligent system. These are systems that are using data that they know about us. They're using trillions, potentially, of points of data that they already have in their databases, and they're making algorithmic predictive choices around what to make visible to us, what to gather about us, how to compute our lives in a nutshell. So, you know, back in the day, as you mentioned, Jeffrey, I was an artificial intelligence developer for a few years, and at that time, we were very interested in this question of whether we could build, you know, a technology that if it was behind like a curtain, kind of like the Wizard of Oz or something, whether human beings would be able to figure out whether it was a human being or not, you know, the AI system. That's what we call in classical AI the Turing test, the T-U-R-I-N-G, Turing test. But more or less, AI was sort of seen as a thought experiment, almost philosophical, almost sort of like a exciting, you know, sort of intellectual achievement. Now AI is influencing everything and anything in our lives. And the reason why is the cost of computation became exponentially cheaper. I mean, think about how fast our phones and computers are compared to the way they were before at a much lower cost. The cost of storage of data became infinitesimally low because anything we put on the cloud is actually accessible and available. No longer do we worry about storage issues. And the third major point that transformed AI are those phones that are in all of our pockets all over the world. They are constantly releasing data 24/7, 365. They're releasing data even when we just think we have them in airplane mode. So there's just all this data that is being mined and gathered and pushed out to server farms and cloud computing networks that companies like Amazon and Alibaba, the Chinese company, they dominate that space. And so that's why AI has come home to roost. The problem, though, and this is a big point I make in Beyond the Valley, in the new book, is AI systems are not neutral. They are biased because they are always influenced by who creates the learning system, right? So if a dominantly white male or even Asian male engineering workforce creates a learning system, they're going to be building technologies that learn from those biases. So AI systems are biased based on who builds them and the data sets that they learn from. And that's why we are seeing, and I give examples of this in Beyond the Valley, across the board, in particular contexts, women being discriminated against by AI systems. Unfortunately, black and brown communities, especially working class communities, being discriminated against by AI technologies. Because AI is no longer a thought experiment. It's being experimented with by police departments, by courtroom departments, and of course by our private technology companies everywhere we know. ICE is using facial recognition AI technologies as we speak right now, which are tending to misidentify people who aren't undocumented as undocumented because of the bias issue, again, that I'm pointing out, and because the databases that they're accessing tend to be dominantly black and brown people.
All right, so these are not, I mean, having our pictures taken are not bits of information that we're volunteering to, at least in this sense, but there's a lot of stuff we do volunteer to. Are you saying, Ramesh, that pretty much anything we use on any internet-connected device is going to report something to someone?
It can all be accessible, potentially. It all sits in different databases and cloud-based networks, and it can be retrievable and accessible. And actually, I also want to point out that it's not even our active use of our phones or our computers or our internet platforms that provides that data. Even when we're simply walking around or driving around with our phones, they're providing data to these different services, which could be used in a range of different ways, right? And so part of the issue here is, you know, fine, if I want to provide Google Maps with my driving data, that's fine, because then Google Maps can offer me efficient services. But that's not what's occurring. It's the reality that that data might also be available to third parties, like the NSA. It's also the reality that the Russian government, you know, and shady organizations like that could not only access that kind of data, but also buy our credit card records, right? So who I am on Facebook is very different than what I do when I buy and sell things or when I buy things on my credit card, right? Do I want that part of my identity to be known alongside my Facebook data, or do I have problems with that? And I would really surmise And every study I see confirms this, that Americans across the board have a big problem with the latter.
There's a concept in the book that I hadn't heard before, solutionism. The term is new to me. What do you mean by it?
Yeah, it's something that a lot of us in Silicon Valley are pretty used to. We sort of think of social life, and obviously we can see pretty clearly political life, as messy and dysfunctional and disorganized and so on. And so, you know, one of the big, you know, it was very exciting, much like my history as an AI developer. You know, I'm from Silicon Valley, actually, Jeffrey. So I'm used to this. I grew up in this. It's the idea that you can build technologies to solve social and human and political problems. It's based on the idea that when you engineer for society, that, yeah, hey, maybe it involves a little bit of social engineering, and that's okay because we're just providing people with tools. Remember, across the board, people traditionally have always thought of science and technology as morally neutral, right? We tend to just think of these technologies as efficient, but now what we're realizing is a lot of these technologies are being built based on the perspectives of engineers who may not be used to understanding the complexity of democracy, the complexity of cultural diversity, but they're building technologies nonetheless to clean up the mess. But the mess is what democracy is, you know? It's part of the process, right? It's part of what makes us human beings. Mm-hmm. And you can't reduce that, flatten that into what these solutionist ideas are all about. And you see them across the board, sometimes applied in the most absurd circumstances.
So there are places, obviously, where you see some limits to what technology can solve for us. There are some things we have to work out as people.
Absolutely. What I'm attempting to do in Beyond the Valley is get to this world of balance. And that's why I'm saying, hey, it's great to have these tech services. We do need to understand that these technologies are here to stay. But let's make sure we understand who governs them. Let's give greater accountability and auditing power to all the communities involved. I mean, imagine, you know, a predictive policing system that Black Lives Matter had some influence around, or a Facebook journalism system, which has been announced by Mark Zuckerberg about 2+ weeks ago, that journalists actually had power over designing as well. You know, it's more about bringing inclusion, you know, bringing diverse stakeholders into the conversation so that they have power over these technologies and how they're created and how they're monetized. So it's really about that theme. It's like about ensuring that technologies serve all of our interests rather than be built upon a zero-sum model. My good is your loss. And that's not the intention, of course, of people in these tech companies, but at the same time, that's the effect that we're seeing occur again and again and again. And, you know, this is particularly troubling, and I do want to make this point quickly, because the vast majority, actually, of internet users, the vast majority even of Google and Facebook users, and don't remember, it's not just Facebook, the social media technology. It's also the platforms they own, like WhatsApp and Instagram. Those are both owned by Facebook, right? So it's the vast majority of those people are not actually here in the United States. They're in places like Africa, Asia, Latin America. So for those billions of people, their lives, their sovereignty are also being impacted.
So let's talk about solutions. Do you propose, among other things, Ramesh, a breaking up of the big five, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Apple, Facebook, any of them?
I think each and their impacts need to be investigated by, you know, regulatory officials and antitrust officials, you know, and basically a sort of regulatory framework that needs to actually have some teeth, unlike what we see today. So, you know, I do think that we should look into that. I'm not sort of just off the cuff going to say, you know, sort of a political slogan like break up big tech. I do think that what we do want, more important than breaking anybody up, is ensuring that they are socially and politically accountable to all of us. And I lay out a number of things that we can do in Beyond the Valley and in this piece, again, that I alluded to, the Digital Bill of Rights that will be coming out. So some of those things are disclosure. You know, people need to know what is known about them. We need to know how what is known about us is influencing what we see. We need to be able to work with those companies and those systems to tell them what information we would prefer for them not to have. Maybe that's naive, but we can at least start that conversation. We need to be able to perhaps even improve our services and experiences by saying, hey, I would like content more on around these themes or those themes. So those are sorts of issues to start. A second sort of general theme would be this point I made earlier to you about auditing those systems. We need to make sure that any system that's going to affect vulnerable, working class, poor people, minority communities, women in harmful ways are audited by those communities, by those organizations. They need to be at the table when it comes not only to how we might design those systems, but even how those systems are used. And one way you can do that in engineering, we kind of talk about, you know, you roll out a system, but you start at a small scale and you learn from its impacts. Because otherwise, when you roll things out too quickly, you so-called move fast and break things, which was sort of an informal slogan at Facebook, you actually create disastrous consequences. You see, for example, Google's image search. When people would search for gorillas on Google and their image system, they get images of black people. You see facial recognition systems across the board, including Chinese ones, misidentify Michelle Obama, Serena Williams, Oprah, all across the board as male. So you see these issues. So that's why auditing inclusivity in the design process is really important. But I also think that on the economic level, and this is where a lot of people are going to be touched, especially, you know, middle and working class people who represent the dominant majority of population of our listeners today, but also people across our country, we need to make sure that what those technologies are being used for don't displace people from their work. And for any people whose work is going to be threatened, as we already see occurring with the gig economy, you know, with Uber driving and so on, we need to make sure that we find alternatives that give them well-compensated work, give them the economic security that they need. Because you have to situate these problems that the current internet, today's internet, poses to working and middle-class people within the backdrop of the profound economic inequalities that we see in the country that, you know, were alluded to by candidates like President Trump in 2016 and certainly are alluded to by some of the Democratic candidates in the 2020 cycle, including Senator Sanders, Bernie Sanders as well.
Let's take a phone call here. Carter in Wolf Creek joins us on the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. My experience, personal experience with the internet is that it drives an imbalance of conceptualization over contemplation. And when I say this, I mean it makes the mind spin and it pushes it away from its natural inclination to rest and be quiet. And we know enough about the human nervous system now and have for a number of decades to know that the quiet spaces between the nerve pulses as we speak are just as important as the pulses themselves. And yet, for some strange reason, in this high-tech culture that we live in, we consistently choose to disregard the spaces and how important they are. And if you have any comment on that and any other books besides your own that are important to you personally, I'm listening carefully.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter. Good to talk to you.
Wow, what a question, Carter. I mean, I can't agree more. I think you've just brought up something really, really important. Yeah, that is a theme, this sort of the absence of, you know, the dopamine-optimized content that internet, that private corporate engines that dominate the internet are optimized for. There's very clear evidence that content that is recommended to us, for example, through recommendation systems on YouTube, like auto-recommendation systems, also content that is made visible to us, is intended to activate and release the dopamine in our minds, which feels stimulating, but ends up leaving us feeling also disoriented and overwhelmed and distraught, and actually is positively correlated with depression amongst many people.
So riled up, but also wanting more. I mean, you talk about the YouTube recommendation algorithm as a great radicalizer, in the words of one person.
Well put. That's exactly it. Because, you know, content you might be viewing, if you look at what's suggested next, it's meant to keep your attention, and attention can very quickly turn into addiction, and we all know how unhealthy addiction is. So Carter's point is, you know, really spot on. You know, as human beings, we also benefit a great deal from contemplation, the word he used. I would also use the word reflection. However, the reason why we've chosen this is not even us as human beings or users of the internet choosing this outcome. The reality is, the companies themselves have figured out a model by which they can get our attention and therefore get our data and behaviorally steer us in whatever ways they want. And that model, and it's a tried and true model for human beings, is to keep their attention, release that dopamine, optimize and focus on that. And we can imagine how not only that is personally unhealthy for us, but on the level of a civic society, on the level of a democracy, which relies on reflection and contemplation and rationality, and an openness and tolerance and compassion to the views and perspectives of others, it's a destructive force when it comes to those themes. So it's in the business model for us to be riled up, overwhelmed, and addicted. Again, not the intention, not the sort of qualitative intention of these companies to have us be this way, but what they are trying to do is optimize for one thing and one thing only, which is keep our attention. And this is a tried and true model that existed long before the internet, of keeping people's attention. Why do we all look at car crashes? Why do we all look at spectacularly hateful content? Or it gets our attention, it riles us up, such as I would argue some of the stuff our president has said. It all works very well to keep people glued. I mean, why does the mainstream media focus so much on some of the crazy stuff that can be said by people in this administration? Again, for these very same reasons, right? So the internet always is a reflection of the popular culture of that time period. And in many ways, we can see the content being provided. For example, conspiracy theories are very good at getting our attention. And you notice across the board, there's great journalism on this, that fake news, conspiracy theory content always ends up bubbling up to the top. Not always, but often does, when it comes to algorithmic systems like Google News, what we see visible on our Facebook feeds and so on, because those computational systems understand that this is what keeps our attention. It's tried and true for human beings. It's our fight or flight instincts.
Yeah, what you and Carter are both saying here reminds me that we're basically sitting at a buffet that never stops serving us. We don't have to get up and go to the table. The table keeps coming to us, and so we just keep consuming as much as we want. I do want to ask you, in addition to the comments about the YouTube recommendation algorithm, since you wrote the book, Facebook announced no ban on false political ads, and I wondered what you make of that.
Yeah, Facebook's model, Facebook's business model is of course expansive, but they get a great amount. They got about $300 million of revenues just in the 2018 midterm elections alone from political ads. So it works for Facebook to have It unfortunately, it does work for Facebook to have a false content be on their platform because, again, it gets people's attention. So, you know, Twitter said it wouldn't run political ads, but Twitter, it's a bit disingenuous because Twitter barely survives as a business model on political ads as a form of content. Facebook, however, claims, you know, free speech, and that's what Mark Zuckerberg did in that speech. He says, we're just supporting free speech, but in a society where the media, and Facebook is the biggest media company in the history of the world. They're not a tech company. They're also a media company. They monetize news media like what we're doing right now. They are the ones who do that. Media are supposed to check falsehoods. Media are supposed to be in a democracy socially and factually responsible. And for Facebook to say, to be quite brazen, I would say, and say that we're not going to worry about that, that's free speech, is actually an abnegation of any form of journalistic duty, all the while they are monetizing journalistic content in a way that no company ever has. We know that 75% of Americans get their news, or at least got their news in 2016 on Facebook. And we also know that the most popular content on Facebook often was conspiracy theory content, or I would say gaslighting type fringe media content that ended up elevating itself into the administration, like Breitbart content.
All right. So it's interesting that, you pointed out early in the book that the likes of Google and Facebook don't create any news content, but also don't regulate any content either. So let's continue down the road of solutions here then, and things that we can do. You talk about going beyond the valley, about innovators around the world. Where in the world are people building alternatives to Silicon Valley-born tech, or is it really just on us to use it differently?
Yeah, it's such a great question. So it is. It's not necessarily on us to use it differently. That's a very tough slog for any of us as internet users. I mean, we can be mindful of what's going on. We can try to do what Carter recommended us to do in his great question. But it is also on us asking and forcing and pushing for tech companies to be socially responsible. However, to your excellent question, many of the innovators across the world in the space of technology are seeing technology in a way that's not zero sum. They're seeing, hey, we can build technology in a way that serves and supports our communities, our environments, our workers, our citizens, right? And I give several examples. I did field work for Beyond the Valley, not just in the United States, where I talked to a number of leading political figures as well and business leaders, but also across the world. You know, I did quite a bit of field work in Kenya, in Latin America, in West Africa as well. Kenya's in East Africa, Uganda, Tanzania, and so on. And in these places, what you see occurring is a different model. It's a model that actually the internet used to look like, and some of us might remember this. It's a community-based model. It's the idea of, hey, we're going to build a Wi-Fi connectivity system. We're going to provide people like an ISP, an internet service provider, or a mobile service provider, but we're going to build it ourselves, and we're going to collectively own this network, and we're going to design it in a way that supports our community, employs people, and serves and supports our own purposes. So I give examples in Beyond the Valley of exactly this, communities that are building their own networks, even indigenous communities. I give examples in Kenya of environmentally conscious companies that are building 3D printers out of almost completely recycled parts. Incredible. Or using solar power as a mechanism to provide connectivity. The point across all of these themes, of all of these examples, is the innovators are living within places and they're designing technologies to serve the people in their communities and also understand the environment, the infrastructural and even the kind of climate issues of their environment. Their responsibilities are not just zero sum. Their responsibilities are to serve and support their communities. So I give examples in Beyond the Valley of AI systems that are built by Ugandans for Ugandans. I give examples of 3D printers, as I mentioned. I have examples of networks that we never imagined. We think that, you know, when we get mobile phone service, we just have to use AT&T services. What if a community built its own network, and it turns out that that network not only provided wealth to everyone in that community, but it was far faster. People don't realize this. The speed of our mobile connectivity in the U.S. is actually slower, 30 times slower than the country of South Korea, the same speed as the country of Kenya. Who would have imagined that? That's because the economic models are not about serving the public. The economic models of all of these tech connectors, from ISPs to mobile service providers, to unfortunately even the brilliant folks in the tech companies mm-hmm. are privately focused. So that's why we have to restore balance, mm-hmm. as they argue in Beyond the Valley.